are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Seattle's Jungle Killer takes you inside a world where depravity and evil are met by some of the best homicide detectives in the Seattle Police Department. One of them, author and retired detective Mike Szczesny, was one of the guys whose mission it was to hunt the men who hunt women. In this real-life murder investigation, you discover how Detective Szczesny and his partners pursued a serial killer's trail and how technique, persistence, and luck prompted the killer to confess the truth. The book that we're featuring this evening is Seattle's Jungle Killer, a detective's account of the first serial killer convicted in Seattle, with my special guest, journalist and author, Mike Szczesny. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Michael Szczesny.
All right, thank you very much for having me, Dan. I really appreciate it, and you did pretty good pronouncing my last name, Szczesny.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I'm notorious for mangling names, so thank you very much for helping me with that. Let's start off, first off, tell us about your background as a Seattle police officer or police officer in general and how many years you were in homicide as a homicide detective.
Well, I started in the police department in 1980. It seemed like only yesterday, but I guess it's quite a ways away. Yesterday in South Chicago, Illinois, in a police department called Calumet City, Illinois, which borders Chicago. I was born and raised in Chicago, then moved to Cal City, and I became a policeman there in 1980. I worked for about 2 years, and had ants in my pants and wanted to move around. So then I moved over to Wyoming, and which was kind of shocking for a Chicago boy to go to Wyoming. And I worked there in Casper for about a year and a half before moving on to Seattle. And I started the police academy in Seattle on my birthday, October 3rd. But it was October 3rd, 1983 is when I started. And I worked patrol for a couple of years. Then I was recruited to work undercover narcotics during the drug wars in mid-80s. And then I went into a robbery unit in 1990, I believe. And I worked with robberies. And I rotated along with a homicide squad. And I was recruited and I was promoted to homicide detective in 1994. And there I stayed for 10 years working regular homicides. And then I think it was around 2004, 2005, somewhere around there. I was asked if I wanted to go to cold case, and that's where I did. I went to cold case and I stayed there for, I think, 12 years. So I never planned on spending 22 years working homicide cases and cold cases, but that's where I ended up going. And it was very rewarding, but I was ready to leave when I left a couple of years ago.
Right. You take us right to a place in Seattle called the Jungle in Seattle's downtown core. Tell us why it's called the Jungle, and before we talk about the first victim found in the jungle, Denise Harris.
The jungle is an area right below east of the old Veterans Hospital, and right next to downtown, right next to the I-5 freeway, which runs north and south, and then I-90, which runs east and west. That's what it's bordered by. And it's probably, I'm not quite sure how big, I'd say, you know, a couple hundred acres, and maybe a little bit more than that. Completely, it's on a deep grade hillside, a lot of foliage and a lot of trees. Mostly people are there are transients, and we call them transients, and people who have mental issues, we call them 220s. That's a signal for someone who has mental issues. And one of the reasons why these people are up there, these transients that have some mental problems, is they cannot function in hanging around with the regular transients downtown. They just don't have the mental capacity to deal with these people, and they end up killing somebody or getting killed themselves. So they want to be by themselves, and that's where they go to these camps. Well, some of these camps, though, there are some other people that go there, and they set up regular, just some are really, really nice, tents and campsites. Some of them are just horrid. I'm talking about what they used to be like. And they go out there, and that's where they hang. They do their drinking there, and they're socializing, and they'll run to places, get food, come back, and that's where they want to stay. And it's like it's just in a different world. But the one thing I really noticed, the only time I'd ever go up there was when I had a dead body or a shooting or something. But loud. It was so loud from the traffic noise, because you're surrounded by the freeways there. And even though you're in this wooded area, it's quite noisy, and it is a very, very spooky place to be.
Let's talk about the first victim, and you talk about this Denise Harris hanging around a bar called the Turf Bar, a restaurant and mm-hmm. bar in the Pike Place Market section of downtown Seattle. And from the bartender, there is a description of what went on and who spotted Denise and her behavior. So tell us a little bit about what this bartender says and observes about Denise Harris this night in the Turf Bar.
Denise was a regular in a few of the bars there, and she come in by herself, and Denise is an attractive woman, African-American, long, thick hair, ponytail to the back. She was a trained teacher, but because of some alcohol and narcotic issues, she could never really hold on a job. She was living with a boyfriend on and off again, but she would just stay there until she'd go out at night and then wouldn't come back for a couple of days. So Denise goes in the Turf Bar, which is no longer there anymore, goes in the Turf Bar, and she sits down there and orders a drink, and I forgot what kind of cigarettes she smoked, but they were like some European type cigarettes. And she'd sit there, and the bartender would say, oh yeah, she was in here. Her usual self, then she starts getting drunk and starts getting nasty with me. And then I end up cutting her off and telling her she's got to get out of here. And she gets up from the table or from the bar and starts walking outside, swinging her long ponytail. And before she walks out, she yells at the bartender and flips him off, and out she goes. When we were doing our canvassing, that's how I ended up running into the bartender and asking him, did you know him? Know her? Oh, yeah, I knew Denise. And also he said, she may have went to this bar and this other bar and this other bar. So I ended up going to like four or five different bars, me and my partner, Dick Gagnon. We go to all these bars. Oh, yeah, we knew Denise. She's a pain. She'd get drunk and then she'd start, going out and getting high with some guys and come back, and she'd just get nastier and nastier until we had 86 or out of the place. And every place we went to, that was about the same story, what we always got about her. And so we're just trying to track her movements down. And that's how it started.
Yeah, you write about the beginning of this investigation when you get involved with this. You tell us how this becomes your assignment and your partner, Dick Gagnon, as you mentioned. So tell us how that comes to you, that you are assigned this case.
How we got assigned this case it's really defined my career later on. I was at a symposium talking about attending a symposium, and we were talking about serial murderers, and And we had different people. We had Ann Rule, the writer who was there. She was presenting some of the cases where I later on became quite friends with. I was in a couple of her books. And we had other, you know, investigators and prosecutors talking about serial murder cases. But as a young homicide detective, you know, and which I was, you know, then in 1997, I never thought I would ever work as serial case. They never gave it any thought. None of us did, because, you know, that's just something that really wasn't, you know, very rarely would somebody work a serial murder case. And so that's you know, that's how it started. And so we came back from going to this class, and we have a thing that's called Next Up. Who's next up for the next homicide? That means it was my partner, Dick Agnew, and I. So they'd say, the next up guys are you. And you got a homicide in the wooded area, in the jungle. He said, oh, you got to be kidding me, in the jungle. Yeah, the jungle, and it's a woman. And so there's a little different twist on things. I say when it's a woman, okay, if it's a usual homicide where some guy's getting, you know, some guy's getting in a fight, some guy gets stabbed, or some gangbangers are, you know, shooting at each other, you know, that's usually the norm. But a woman, okay, so... Dick and I pack up our stuff, and, you know, Dick's, you know, complaining to me, and I'm laughing now because we were supposed to go to, like, I think, a retirement party that night for another homicide detective. And it was a beautiful September day. It was September 12th, 1997, as I call. And so we get out to the jungle, and we go up there, and there's the state police are around there, and I talked to this trooper, and the trooper says, yeah, I was sitting over here on the side of the road writing up some reports or some citations, and two transients came, and they said, hey, there's a body up over here. Come with us. We'll take you to it. Well, he's smart enough. He's not going to go up into the jungle with these two transients. So he calls for some backup, and he goes up there with five other troopers, and they're marching on up there, and then all of a sudden, there they get, and there they see the victim, who was later identified as Denise Harris, laying down, she's on the ground, and fully clothed. Her pants are a little bit dirty. She's wearing gym shoes. She's got a gag in her mouth, and you know, there's a ligature around her neck also, and her hands are tied. And so I'm looking down, and they're looking at the body down, and I'm looking and saying, well, what's, you know, something just really, really looked out of place. And it was the bindings on her hand, well, they're from her shoelaces. And I could look down, right, and I could see that, you know, her shoes are on, but there's no laces in them. And the hands, like, when I talk about this, you know, if you're going to tie somebody up, you're going to tie their hands together, right? Their wrists together, mm-hmm, in front of them or the back of them to restrict your movement. It's like when you put handcuffs on somebody, you get them cuffed up, get them behind your back, because, you know, you want them free. Well, her hands, these laces are tight on her wrists, but her hands are like about, you know, so what's the use of that? You know, I thought it was kind of weird, unless you do, maybe it's easier to carry somebody. So she has no identification. There's no purse there. Or a wallet on the ground. And there's, in fact, besides those other two transients, it's the only one of the people we see in there. So we take care of business. So we, you know, we process the scene, and we don't process the scene. We have another team processing the scene. And she's right next to this one little homeless camp. And one of the things I noticed, they have, you know, you can tell people would be sitting around drinking and throwing the beers into a pile. I mean, I don't know how many people were doing it, but a huge pile. But on one of the branches, there's an impaled beer can. I thought that was kind of weird. You know, just a little branch sticking on, somebody stuck it on there. And that will come into play later down in the story. So when I tell the detectives, the scene detective said, take a picture of that. They said, you know, we took pictures of everything. Why don't you take a picture of a can of beer? And just, you know, humor me. And I don't forget doing it. And they're kind of, they take a picture of the can. I said, it's kind of identifiable. And then off we go to, you know, trying to identify the victim. And then later on, we do get a a name and an address for her, and here and the name was Denise Harris. And so we find her address. We go to me and Dick Agnew. We go to her address, knock on the door, and the gentleman opens the door. And he's, you know, what can we do for you? You know, he goes, this is about Denise, right? I said, yes, sir. And he goes, she dead? Me and my partner looked at him and said, yes, she is. He goes, come on in. And then he goes on to tell us a story. He goes on to tell us a story about her and about how she'd be, you know, she'd be going off and she'd have a drinking problem and narcotics and sleeping around. And she even gave him a disease one time. So he told us. And it was, but it was very, you know, we found out where he was at lately. He gave us a picture of her. And it was just very, very, it was very sad. As we walked out of the place, we gave our cards, and we walked, and Dick and I, and Dick goes, oh, what do you think? I said, eh, that's not the guy. And Dick said, yeah, he gets, you know, sad sap, you know. And here he stays with this woman, and he knows she's out running around and, you know, been drunk and sleeping around, and he's still, you know, but he's in love with her. You know, they met, I think they met in Las Vegas or something. So now we got her name. We got to try and identify who she was with. That's when we went to all the bars that she would hang out at, and she was mostly a loner, no girlfriends or nothing like that, but just going out there drinking, and they had substance abuse problem, which many of the victims. When you have a case like this, are having some kind of drug problem. So we worked the case for months, you know, chasing down leads. Maybe it's this guy, maybe it's that guy, and not getting anywhere. And in the meantime, we're still, homicide, you know, this is in September, and so other cases are coming up and stuff. We got to go work other cases, work other crime scenes. And but when you're in a case like this, you know, you're really working because it was so unique. I mean, with having somebody tied up and bound and stuff like that. And that's what we did. And so we just kept working the case. And then another victim came into play. Her name was, you know, Antoinette Jones. They called her Tony. And once again, she's another girl. She was half white, half African American, and street life, prostitution, mostly drug abuse, and kind of a petite thing. And she'd hang out in the Pioneer Square area, which is right downtown. But we find her body, a couple of transients are walking, and collecting like boxes, cardboard. And the guy pulls over this cardboard, and there's a decomposed body. And later, and identified as Antoinette Jones. Well, her skeletal remains, and they got her up on an autopsy table and took a picture of her. And you can see she has a ligature around her throat and a gag in her mouth, and it's skeletonized now. And so there's a skull, and it's very creepy-looking picture, you know, because there's a skull with the mouth wide, gaping open, and with the, I think it was either brassieres or panties, was used as a gag in her mouth. And then her hands were bound also. And we're looking, well, are those, you know, later on. It wasn't my case. It was another detective's, Clyde Seiger's case. And then it comes up, and she had shoelaces on her hands also. So we're working the case. Well, actually, it wasn't Clyde Seiger's case. It was some other detective's case. And they're working the case. And till later on, they says, now, this looks like the same killer for both of the cases. And they decided to, the powers that be decided to give us the cases to work both of them. Yeah, which we do. So we start working the case and chasing down leads, interviewing, once again, interviewing transients that may have some mental issues, you know, and don't really want to be there, but, you know, they are cooperating semi. And so there we just go on and keep working. And I'm working all the cases, and it was a now we're getting into the winter.
Mm-hmm.
We're getting into winter, and get a phone call. I get a phone call. You got a collect call from the King County Jail from Dwayne Harris. Do you accept the charges? Yeah, accept charges. I get those all the time. All the detectives, the guys calling up, they want to get out of jail, they want to help us find the bad guy or, whatever. And this guy starts talking to me about the case. And he said, I'll help you with that case. You got to come get me out of jail. And I just went, that's what I want. I want to be out of here. Yeah, right, yeah. Call me back when you have something. Well, he does call back. In fact, I come in sometimes and I have 4 or 5 messages on my phone from this guy. So he goes, I'll tell you something about this case. I just went out. He goes, I was there, man. I know the guy who probably did this because I was there. He goes, I'll tell you something that you don't know. You never found a purse, did you? And I'm thinking, man, how do you know that, Because we didn't find a purse. So I end up later on, I go and I get him out of jail and we bring him out of jail and he takes us up to the crime scene. And he's a big guy. He's really a big guy. Now, Dwayne Harris is his name and no relation to Denise Harris. And he's got a tattoo on his arm, that Chili Willie. They call me Chili Willie. And he's got a couple little tattoo tears down his cheek, which some gangs say that's like for a move, which kind of shooting a gang member or something. But right. it changes. We got him. He's a pretty strapping dude. I'm 6'6". He's probably at least 6'1", lean. Yeah. And you can tell he's kind of a tough dude. So we have ankle chains on him, and we also have a big belt around his waist with he'd be handcuffed to his side. And he says, "Yeah, this is where he brings us up there, and he's pretty close to where he puts Denise Harris's body up in the jungle." Yeah, but he says, "In fact, her head was this way and her feet were that way." I said, "Okay, sounds good." And then we're walking around. Yeah, I said, "Once again, it's." The foliage, the ground changes so much because the foliage and stuff, this is the winter. And he's walking in there, and he says, matter of fact, he's turning around, he's looking, he goes, there's a tree over here, man, because I stood up, and I hit my hand on this tree branch, and there was like a beer can impaled on it. And I hit my forehead on it, cut my head, I said, God, And so right there, I thought, this dude was up here, man. This guy was up here. Now, whether he's a killer or where he was getting this information from, because all these guys they'll say they are there just to get it, to get out of jail or something. So
back. Mike, what did he say though when he initially called? He didn't admit that he was involved. He had said that there was someone else that he knew. So when you go to this, when you take him out of jail, you and Dick, or when you went with Cloyd to the jungle, he still stuck with that story that he was an accomplice that just happened to know all this information. And you guys played along with it, didn't you?
Yes. He's saying, I was with this guy, Mike Smith, is the way he said the guy's name. He gave a description of the guy. And it's funny, the description was almost of him. I was like, well, once again, like I said, we don't have any leads really to speak of. And when he says the thing about the beer can, he was up here before. He knows that, but so what? So he's a transient drug using guy. He kind of knows that. But when he says that about her, the way she was tied up, and he made that face, and he says, "Yeah, she had something in her mouth," and he opens up his mouth, showing like the gag that he had. Denise had in her mouth. So we're thinking, this cat was up there, So that was, now I'm getting phone calls from this guy, collect, you got a collect call from the King County Jail. And he's trying to, he's going to help us out, you know, he's going to tell us where this, that's at, trying to find out where this alleged suspect's at. And I can tell, you know, he gave us a little bit of truth and a couple of lies also. Mm-hmm. And so then he says, and I'll tell you something, you never found a killer about that girl up in the woods at what other place there, did you, man? That body, you know, Antoinette Jones, I think he called her Tony. And he said, no, and he goes, I'll take you up there. So we went up there, and he says, yeah, she was over here. He was, over, you know, this is the way her body was and stuff. Oh, okay. He was pretty close all about that, you know, about what, where they were and what happened. So we go out and pick this guy up from jail, and he was in the Kent jail, which is just south of the city here. It's in the county, but it was south city, so it was kind of a pain to drive all there. Pick him up every day, every morning, and go drive around, and, you know, looking for people that may know or looking for this Smith guy. And he's providing us information the whole time. And I'm like, oh, okay. But, you know, once again, half the stuff is true, half the stuff is, you know, baloney. You know, we're not buying it, and we're not trusting the thing. We're watching him very closely, thinking that he's going to try to escape, you know. And, but it goes on until finally, we're going to take him. We're going to go find some other. He's going to take us to where some other body is. And I got him sitting up in my office, and with a cup of coffee, or he'd call it a cappuccino. Man, give me one of them cappuccinos, will you, man? So okay, we'll give you a cappuccino, chili. And he says, you know. Well, so let me back up by something. He says, let me take you where you never recovered the purse, did you? Let me take you where he threw the purse. And so we went to the area, and he says he threw it down some sewer or something like that. I had the city come and pump out the sewer and stuff, and I never did recover that, the purse. Finally, you know, after going out with this guy for, maybe it must have been like 3 weeks, I come back to the room one time, and a couple of guys, even my partner, Dick Gagnon, saying, now this is going to be BS, and I don't trust this guy. He's going to try to do something, you know, we're trying to placate him. And, but what else are we going to do? So all of a sudden I come back to the room, and he's, let's take us out. We're going to go back in the jungle. I come back in the room where he's sitting there. We give him a magazine, a couple smokes, and this cappuccino. And he says to me, he says, Mikey Mike. That's who he used to call me, Mikey Mike. He goes, I'm tired. I'm really tired. I'm going to tell you the truth. I killed those two. And I killed that other bitch, too, up there. And I said, mother of a bitch. He goes, that Olivia Smith, man. And I said, oh, okay. And so everyone said, sit tight a minute, and went back outside, got a rights form, told my partner Dick Gagnon, who was getting his boots and stuff, getting ready to go up there looking for more bodies. I said, hey, he just confessed that he did the murders and Olivia Smith. I think that's Steiger's case, Cloyd Steiger. I said, you better get him a call coming here. I'm going to start talking to him. And Gagnon looking at me, he says, are you shitting me? I said, truth, buddy. Okay. So off I go. I go back in there, and I've taken a confession from him. And shortly after that, my other partner came in, Steiger came in. He did a confession on the Olivia Smith case. Now, Olivia Smith, she was her body was found on January 10th, 1998, in a stairwell, at the bottom of a stairwell. And she had been... throat had been cut, and she'd been stabbed numerous times in the chest and also in the buttocks. Superficial wounds in the buttocks. I forgot the term is for it. It's when they stab you Or sometimes you do, it's like they're playing, you know, they just experiment and they start stabbing you and stabbing victims in the buttocks area. But she had her throat severely cut. I mean, it was, and her hand was cut, and there was blood all over. I'm looking at the crime scene photos because I didn't go to that scene. But I could see that, you know, she was, you know, one of her shoes was off her foot, you know, and she's laying there in a crumpled position. But looking at the photographs from close, you could see where there was a lot, but once again, there was a lot of blood already. And there was a lot of blood that has happened in the shoe cut. But her shoelaces were half out of one shoe. But you can't really put that together with anything, with the other cases that where our victim was tied up with her shoelaces. But Shirley told us later on, he told us what happened. He said, I was smoking some crack with her, and I was kind of killing her the whole time, and I got behind her, and I started to choke her, and all of a sudden she pulled the knife out, and she cut my hand. He shows his wound on his hand, and he has a scar on his hand. And so I was be able to get it back, and I just started stabbing her in the throat, and I cut her throat, and then I stabbed her buttocks, in the ass, and I was taking her shoes off, but I was losing so much blood, and it was really cold out that day. And he took the Steiger who worked there. He said, yeah, it was like, you know, when he responded to that call, it was like, you know, 7 degrees outside. Mm-hmm. And she goes, oh, so Julie said, oh, I'm passing out. So I had to leave. You know, I didn't want to leave, but I had to leave. The reason why, later on working with serial murder cases that I had, these guys, you know, it's the killing part is really boom, boom, boom. They enjoy that. They get off on that. Then they enjoy being with the body and either tying them up or whatever. There's a lot of times you find out what is their signature. His, like I said, his was tying up the bodies. Sometimes it's positioning of the body and the killers will insert things into the victim's, body. And they all have a little, and the way they position the legs is spread out all the way or put them on their knees and stuff. They like spending time with them. They'll think about it all the time. That's what serial murderers do. They're sociopaths. They'll think about it over and over and over again. That's all they do. No, they don't have any. They can show like they have emotion there, but they don't have any emotion. It's not like you and I don't feel sorry about anything. Nothing. All they think about is killing. And I don't care. I have these guys that killed people 30 years ago, and that's exactly how they did. They'll tell you the color of the drapes. Now, where they got the knives, what the person said to them. And that's how Chili was, and that's what he was doing. So Chili had he kills Olivia Smith. He stabs her to death. Then he's got this gash and he crosses his hand. He goes to a hospital in Longview, Washington, which is like about 100 miles away from here. But then he has to split from there because, they give him drugs and that, and he thinks, they're going to call the cops on him. So he just leaves from there, and that's it. So he's almost all the way scot-free until he does an armed robbery. He gets arrested for that. Then he gets bored inside the jail, and he calls me. And we go from there.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second, Mike, for these messages. Now you have, you are questioning this Chili Willy. Now that he's admitted to you, he says, listen, I'm tired, as you mentioned. I'm tired. I've been killing my whole life. I want to get this off my chest. I want to deal with this. You did have a rapport with him. You had a relationship with him. He seemed to like you, trust you.
Yeah.
So now with this admission of this, how do you go about corroborating this? And what about the story about Mike Smith? When is that whole notion dispelled?
All the way at the end. He hangs on that for a little while, and then all of a sudden, halfway through, after he confessed, he mentioned that is a completely BS. I did have a rapport with him. I think he didn't really have much of a rapport with Dick. And Cloyd, he didn't like Cloyd all that much. I think part of the reason why is we'd have a van. We'd drive a van either. Mm-hmm. Cloyd would drive, Ryan would drive. And when I'm driving the van and we got Chili handcuffed, in the back seat, And there's Coy sitting back there with a, you know, with a sawed-off shotgun. And he says, Chili said, "Man, what are you going to do with that shotgun?" He goes, I'm gonna kill you if you try to run. He goes, "Man, you wouldn't do that." He goes, "Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would."
Yeah, I would.
I bet I would. And then we're getting out of the van. We're back in our police station. And we're in the basin going to go upstairs. And Coy jokingly goes, "Look out, Mike. I think he's running. Be careful." And Chili says, "Oh, man, knock that stuff off, man. Would you? Come on, man. Let's get out of here." And it was a little comic relief, you know. I'm thinking, and it was about my mind. And we would have had to dump him if we had to. Once again, I kept thinking, and the sergeants kept thinking. My sergeant Dave Ritter and Dick Gang, he always thought, he goes, "This guy's been, you know, you guys are, we're taking too much time with this guy, because we had him like 3 weeks, and and you think, you know, something bad's going to happen. This guy's going to try to get away, or he's going to get away, or he's going to hurt you guys. You guys end up killing him. You know, we don't need that." So finally we make decision. All right. Because now he's starting to give us some false leads also, said he killed this person, he killed that person. And we know he's a bad guy but some of the things are true, that, you know, he gives us a little bit of truth to, and then he fabricates some other stuff. But I had, during that same time period, right before he confessed, I had a case where I had a couple of guys killed in a motel room, and there was a girl, a young prostitute in there, a crack whore, as they would describe her. And I had to go pick her up from her house and stuff, and she was going to be a material witness. And she said about, we're talking to her about the case, about her and the lifestyle that she has and how dangerous it is. She goes, "Oh, yeah." She says, "It's always scary, you know, when you're out there hooling." And she goes, matter of fact, "This is the first day I had these shoes on." She pulls her legs out. I mean, shows me these shoes that she got, these little high, like high heel type shoes and stuff. She goes, "There's this guy, man. His name was Chili Willie. And I was in a motel with him and this other guy. And then all of a sudden, you know, he wanted to have sex with me, and he, you know, strips me naked and throws me in the bathtub and is like washing me and stuff. And then all of a sudden, he, you know, he beat up the other guy and tied him up, and I ran out the door and I got away. And I never wanted to be around that guy. I still look for him. I still think he's going to kill me." Well, then I'm listening to Chili Willie, and wow, it's the same guy. And that's the guy I was interviewing before at the same time. So, so talking to Chili, I bring her name up there, and he goes, "Oh man, that, you know, that bitch." And he goes on, and he almost explains the same thing, tells us the same about the same story. And then how he wanted to kill her. And he kept telling me, see, and whenever we would talk to Chili, and he'd almost get like in a trance-like state. You probably know more about why these guys did, but he, all of a sudden his voice would get deep, and he'd be talking, and we have his hands, you know, in a leather belt type deal with cuffs on, and I could see where he's talking to us, and he's there, and he's manipulating his hands like they're around somebody's throat. And he says, I'd tell him, yeah, you know, she'd be begging for her life. And I said, "Yeah, you go tell that to God right now, because ain't nothing happened here. You're going to be dying, bitch." And I said, "Ooh, smokes." And it just scared it. And this girl, she was scared that. And Chili kept telling me he wanted that. He'd see her around town once in a while. And all he wanted to do was get her alone to kill her. And that girl, I mean, by the grace of God, she got away. He definitely killed her. He wanted to kill her so bad.
Yeah. You also talk about, interestingly, he asked for his wife, and they've only been married, the poor woman, they've only been married 4 months, and he calls her to the police station. Tell us just a little bit about this incredible interaction and what he says to her and admits to her, and then later that's part of your testimony at trial.
Oh yeah, he comes. He brings her to if I'm recalling this right, we bring her over there, and he wants to see her a little bit. And he tells her, you know, honey, I'm sorry, I've been doing all this kind of stuff, and this habit be coming on you, but this is just what I am. You know, I've always been doing this kind of stuff. And she's like, this girl, she's just like, you know, shaking her head. She's just like, she's distraught. And he tells her that he's killed several people, and that's just the way it is, you know? and she tells us also that she was in Portland when she noticed that his hand was bandaged. And she asked him, what happened to your hand? And she said, I killed someone. And she just disregarded it, and because, you know, just says, you know, he talks crazy stuff like that all the time. Well, it wasn't all that crazy. That's actually what he did.
Yeah, and then so now you have these reports, and you have other people that you speak to as well that he had spoken to. Somebody from the jungle as well. So now you have this case for the prosecutors. What is their next move with this evidence that you've gathered? And so what is their next move?
Well, we got the prosecutors. They're involved. We call them MDOT, Most Dangerous Offenders Program. They're around us. Like they would see some of the interviews that we did when we had them in another room, and we're keeping them apprised of everything we're doing. But they're also getting a little antsy, also thinking, you know, we hope this guy doesn't escape. You know, we don't want this guy posting bond for his robbery and all of a sudden walking out, and we're never going to see him again. But then again, there's the plan, and so they said, at one point we think he's going to, you know, plead out, you know, they're going to give him whatever. He's going to get life, but he's going to plead out. But no, we finally formally arrest him for the murder and put him in jail. And the prosecutors, and we have two of the, you know, we have really, really good prosecutors, the head of the MDOP unit, Jeff Baird, you know, very sharp guy. He's going to be prosecuting the case, and we set the bail set really high for him. And so then we go to trial, and his defense attorney, who's a really good guy, well, I know the guy, he's a good guy also. We're kind of laughing between ourselves, myself and Detective Steiger and Gagnon, you know, thinking, it seems that the defense attorney is a little bit afraid of his client. And then we're laughing, yeah, wouldn't you be afraid of him also? Because surely he had a couple outbursts in court, and like he did before he was arrested for this in his other case, where he's throwing stuff around. And so we had to put him in what we call a Hannibal Lecter chair, because now he's misbehaving in front of the judge. And Marge Peckman, I think, who is a judge, she's now a federal judge, and or I think she's retired by now, but they had to put him in a Hannibal Lecter chair because he was, you know, throwing stuff. And so what is it? You're in a chair and you're strapped in there, and they bring you in front of the jury, and sometimes he's good. Sometimes he won't change his clothes, get into civilian clothes. It's something you don't want to bring the guy in there, you know, in his jail outfit. And, but no, he just had all these outbursts all the time. And sometimes it was very comical watching him perform. And then again, I look over at the jury while when he started talking, and or if the medical examiner's office, doctors, they're talking about positions of the body and the strangulations. And I'm looking at all the jurors, and you can see even some of the men, and we won't see all the women, but even some men, they'd be, you know, their legs are crossed, their arms are crossed, and their hands are up across their throats, you know, because... Just, once again, Dwayne or Chili was very chilling, man, very, very chilling. So yeah, when he finally found the witness stand and talked, he says, oh, yeah, Detective Szczesinski or Szczesinski, Szczesinski, you know, he'd make that stuff up, you know. He goes, I killed you know, Olivia Smith. I admit I killed her. It's because the DNA came back because they had his blood. But the other two, I just, you know, I was just talking bull, you know, man. Like, he just, you know, let me look the reports and all that kind of stuff. You know, of course, it was all nonsense, and he was found guilty. And I think he was sentenced to 204 months, something like that, for each case, something. So obviously, he's not going to be getting out.
So then I see
him in they got him in the Hannibal Lecter chair and wheeling him out, the guards, you know, and he'd always have a, you know, circle of guards around him. Hey, Mike, you know, why don't you give me a call, man? Come on, come and see me. Give me one of those cappuccinos, man. I'm sorry I said those things about you in there. Okay, Chili. Maybe I will. Let me jump. I know you probably have some other questions for me, but when the day I was retiring here, and I think it was in 2017, I had to go to one of the prisons, go talk to somebody else on my last day. And I said, as long as I'm here, I think I'm going to give Delane Harris a phone call and see if I can talk to him. And so, not a phone call. I said, well, I'm there. I told the guards, let me see if Delane Harris come down and see me. So, and this is in the prison there. And so they, I know, was it in Walla Walla? I forget which prison it was. Anyway, they bring him down, and he comes walking in there with his big old glasses on. He's about 50 pounds heavier. He goes, Zinsky, so you're still here, huh? I said, yeah, Chili, how you doing? He goes, I'm doing okay. Where's your buddy Steger at? I'm referring to Steger. I said, he's busy, but he sends his love. He goes, yeah, I bet he does. And he's kind of looking me up and down. And I was, you know, dressed, you know, in a suit, you know, and I was, you know, wearing the homicide detective dress. And he goes, yeah, you still dressing pretty good, I see. He goes, I always liked that about you. You always dress good. He goes, that's why I used to dress all the time. I always had a suit on and stuff, which I knew was all baloney, because he always had, like, you know, jeans on, fatigues on, because he told me, you know, that jail wouldn't be all that bad for him, because he got tired of trying to find places to crash, to sleep, and to get 3 square meals a day. And, you know, basically, you know, he'd married a couple of women, you know, but that, of course, those never worked out. And, but he said, yeah, it'll be all right. I'll be in jail. And I'll be in jail. I get 3 squares a day. He'd be washing my, I get myself on them homosexuals, wash my jeans and curl my hair. I'll smoke a joint whenever I want to. I won't have you hounding me. That's what he told me. Oh, okay. What a life to be looking forward to.
Yeah, incredible. You talked about his performance at the trial when you said he started throwing things, because he was known to maybe throw things from the defense table. He actually threw a chair into the gallery. And then he was calling, the judge tramp bitch. You said that what you had hoped for is that he would have to go against a female prosecutor. So the second chair was this Barbara Fleming. And so you got your wish there. And then as well, you talked about the female judge, Marsha Peckman. So he really was infuriated, because you knew that he had just no use for women, period. So with having them, a judge and a prosecutor involved in his case, he got more than testy, because the thing is, he had already admitted to things, and there was almost a slam dunk in terms of evidence against him, and yet he still gave the court a performance and a challenge, didn't he?
Yes, exactly what he did. It was because for him, you know, he knew he's never going to get out again. He knew that. So the longer he can stay, like, guys, it's funny, most guys, like, getting out of the county jail and go in the penitentiary, people don't think that that's how it is. But, yeah, that's how it is, because the county jail is so boring. Television once in a while. There's no more working out. You know, they don't have any of that. You know, there's no more lifting weights and all that kind of stuff. People get fat in there. They get get 3 meals a day. Not very good feel. Good food. You get your phone. You still get a phone call, but you are just bored. It's noisy. It's, you know, it's transient. It's, now you go to prison, now all of a sudden, now you might be able to get smokes, you get your own coffee, you get a job, You wear different clothes. You can watch TV, and as things go on, and it depends which prison you end up going to. Sometimes you get softer clothes. You know, sometimes you get your own room. You go to school. You know, they have ways of getting, you know, ways of getting drugs and having sex and stuff. But it's we call it normal. It's more of a normal life than anything else. But county jail is hard. But he liked it in county jail. They had to keep him in seclusion because he was a bad boy, and he'd always end up getting in fights or threatening people and stuff. So Chile, he didn't know really what he wanted. But he's definitely, you're right about that, though. He definitely, it was a nice play by having a female judge, which is just by the luck of the draw that we got Marsha Peck and someone who was very good. Once again, I said what went on the Spirit of Clue, and Barb Fleming. And Barb happened to be the prosecutor when he was in there for a robbery beef initially. And he was throwing stuff around, and he could be, you know, he could be very scary sometimes. And one time, you know, and all the time we had together, me and him were doing his model thing. I don't know how that transpired. But, and he's saying, you know, I ain't like them boys you used to deal up here. I ain't like them punks. And I go, I'm not probably one of the detectives that you used to. He goes, yeah, that's right. You know, I can tell you're a little tough. And he goes, if it came down to it, though, I guess, well, maybe one of us wouldn't come out of here alive. And I said, yeah, that's probably what it would be, actually. And just kind of smiled at me, kind of smiles at me and stuff. And he's right. I always thought if something happened, you know, it's going to be me and him. It's going to be boom, 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 boom. Because I'm not going to let him put his hands on me. And it's kind of crazy.
It's interesting the relationship you seem to have when you go see him. And he says, you know, I'm sorry about all the things I said to you, because really, you and Cloyd and Dick Gagnon really were the instrumental people in putting him away. Even the tapes of the conversations in the office and when you were driving were played in court. Your testimony was crucial. And the witnesses that you gathered, like the Ayesha, who had been her tied up by him, which showed the shoelace MO that he used for his victims, you were instrumental in putting this person away, and yet he seemed to have this sort of, well, you just did your job and I just did what I did sort of attitude, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. And even at the end, when I went to visit him at the end, you know, he's been in prison here for 20 years and in numerous prisons, and he wasn't as warm to me as he was before, but that happened. But he for some reason he warmed to me a little bit more than he did the other two guys. I was with him probably the most because Dick wasn't with him all that much toward the end, and so it was just like Cloyd and I, but I was the one who was with him every single day. And there was a time when I forgot what holiday it was, Labor Day, Memorial Day. And I would check my phone messages from my home, and there's a message on there, and it's from King County Jail, and it's from Chile, and he's calling Mikey Mike, and remember today, and matter of fact, I'm sitting in the same chair it was, hey Mikey Mike, this is Chile, it's a holiday, you're probably not coming to get me today, and I'll probably see you Tuesday then, okay man. Have a nice holiday. And so then I played a recording in for my wife. And I said, now, when was the last time you had a serial killer tell you to have a nice holiday, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, I said, how do you talk to that guy? How do you listen to him? And he said, that's just, you know, being friends with Chili. And so that was kind of it, you know, with Chili. And that was my last visit with him. And people say, do you want to go talk to him again? I go, no, not really. I don't want to see him. He's still flourishing. He's in one of our prisons here in the state. But Chile now is he's in the probably late 50s now. He had hepatitis. He told me, he said he had hepatitis right from the needles that he was using. He would use some needles and some injecting himself with heroin. So he said, yeah, and he had that, and he had hepatitis, and he was diabetic. He had some other health issues. But it was, I think back on it, I go, oh, that was the first serial murder that we ever did in Seattle. You know, we had Ted Bundy and all that, but we never charged them in Seattle. So that was the first serial murder charge in Seattle, and that was 1998. And I just, by the luck of the draw, I was just the guy, one of the guys who was, you know, on that case. And then I moved into a cold case unit in 2004. And once again, never even dreamed, thought I'd work in serial murder cases or had any desire to work serial murder cases because those are, you know, that's, you know, a lot of work. I ended up, just because of DNA and the job that I was in, I worked like 11 serial murder cases, but I convicted 7 serial murderers. At time, I think, was like one of the, you know, detectives that I, you know, did the most serial murders. Somebody brought this up to me, another detective, a reporter that I did the most serial murders in the United States. It was just, I was just in the right place, right time. Not that I was a great detective, you know, put the blood was in there and stuff, and it came back and then matched this guy, and he was in prison. I would talk to the guy, and I did get better interviewing these guys, but I did notice all the same thing about these guys who would, you know, tie these women up or strangle them a certain way or stab them a certain way or rape them. It had nothing to do with sex. Now, a lot of these guys are on the motion, like they're, you know, penetrating them. They're not even penetrating them. And what the motion they're getting out of is throttling their neck or stabbing them 30 or 40 times or stabbing them 20 times in the front, 20 times in the back, redressing them or posing them afterwards. Nothing to do with sex. And the same thing like what Chili said one time. He was mad at me. You know, when I would talk to him, you guys said I raped him, but I didn't rape them. And they gave it to me. And I said, you know what? And I said, yeah, you're right. They did. And every one of them, that was their MO. They would do whatever they wanted for sex. And but once again, Chili was right. It had nothing to do with sex. And so it's kind of crazy that, you know, we're talking about now, and so you've talked about this with a lot of other detectives, and you probably know just as well as I do, that it isn't about the sex of these guys. You know, it's like he always says, it ain't about the sex, it's all about the killing. He said, thank you, Chili.
Absolutely right. Very interesting, too, that Cloyd Steiger that you mentioned was a guest on the program this year with his book, Seattle's Forgotten Serial Killer, about Gary Jean Grant, another fascinating serial killer from the same area. And Seattle, very much like the West Coast, has got a lot more serial killers than anywhere else, it seems, historically. The West Coast is notorious.
It does seem that way. I think we probably caught up, you know, the DNA, and people are kind of finally catching up. And it's kind of slowed down after 2020. And like I said, I convicted 7 serial murders myself. And I'll be writing another book here real soon about one. And I was left because you know, telling me you must really like serial murders and true crime. I go, not really. You know, I read sometimes a book or 2 books, you know, 3 books a week, and none of them about true crime because that's why, you know, that's what I do. And it really is. Thankfully that where DNA came around and we were able to convict so many people across the country.
Absolutely.
I'm sure some of your guests did.
Yeah, it's thank God for DNA, absolutely. Without it, be much different.
But
it's,
you still have to do the interview, you know?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. It still comes down to the proper police work and that running down leads and running down every lead and investigating every single thing. And as this case points out, too, there's a lot of luck along with that police work as well. A couple breaks, lucky breaks.
Like I would never have gotten some of my witnesses just on a completely different case, you know, and all of a sudden Yeah, look at my, you know, I'm wearing the shoes today, you know, when Chile did this one. Holy smokes. It's just crazy. It's just crazy. And, but I'm happy that, I never wish anybody dead. Most of the serial murders cases that I did, I think only three of the guys are alive now because they're, you know, put in prison or they're sentenced to, you know, another life to them and they're dying off. And, no matter how cold, I don't want anybody, none of them. So yeah, I'm happy he's dead. But yeah, I'm still kind of surprised. I'm sitting here looking at Chili Willie's booking photo, and you know he's 6'1". Geez, it's hard to believe it. That was a big part of my life, and like I said, I've done a couple of shows, and I wrote my book, Seattle Jungle Killer, and still, out of all the serial murderers that I've ever worked, he is by far the spookiest. By far.
Absolutely. Yes, and thank God, too, as I say about for DNA, but thankfully, lots of these guys are not geniuses, thankfully,
no.
And their narcissism takes over any kind of reasonable thoughts. And so he gave you a call on the phone that day and tried to play you. Fortunately,
yes.
You were an experienced police officer, and he, as well over his head, again, narcissistic and just believing that he could fool people as he had fooled people all along in his career.
Yes.
And thankfully
and,
you and
you're
Cloyd.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. That's how it was. These guys, they really, you know, some of the guys that I've dealt with, you know, were intelligent to a degree, just to a degree. But they at one time or another, especially in Chile, is a perfect example of that, as you point out, is they think they really believe that they're really smart. Because who are they hanging with? You know, they're very conniving, and they have a bit of intelligence. They know how to connive people. And with Chili's, you know, what's the hook for him? He had the drugs for the women, you know, and he had the gift of gab. And he would tell me, how do you think I'd get these women to come up into the jungle? You know, I just have to, you know, I'd tell him about some cocaine stuff and. That's just how you know, you got to get him up here, but you got to remember. Mayor Cloyd asked him, what was your plan, Chili? What was your plan with these? Murder, man. Murder, murder, murder.
Yeah.
I said, holy smokes.
That's wild.
I know. So
thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me, and I'm going to listen to your show, and I hope I can be on again for one of my next cases.
Well, we look forward to your next book, and absolutely we'll have you on to interview about that. So thank you so much for coming on and talking about your book, Seattle's Jungle Killer, a detective's account of the first serial killer convicted in Seattle. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Mike Szczesny. You have a great evening.
Bingo.
Thank you so much.
You too, sir. Thank you. Bye-bye.